the glow of the torches, and it was like a sound, a boot heel on a wooden floor, a fist on the lid of a coffin. 7. Although there were benches and long trestle tables, only the old folks ate their dinners sitting down. And a famous dinner it was, with literally 200 dishes to choose among, most of them homely and delicious. The doings began with a toast to the Kala. It was proposed by Von Eisenhart, who stood with a bumper in one hand and the feather in the other. Eddie thought this was probably the Crescent's version of the national anthem. "May she always do fine," the rancher cried and tossed off his cup of graff in one long swallow. Eddie admired the man's throat, if nothing else. Kala Bryn Sturgis's graff was so hard that just smelling it made his eyes water. "Do ya?" the Folkin responded, and cheered and drank. At that moment, the torches ringing the pavilion went the deep crimson of the recently departed sun. The crowd oohed and awed and applauded. As technology went, Eddie didn't think it was such of a much, certainly not compared to Blaine the Mono or the dipolar computers that ran Ludd, but it cast a pretty light over the crowd and seemed to be non-toxic. He applauded with the rest. So did Susanna. Andy had brought her wheelchair and unfolded it for her with a compliment. He also offered to tell her about the handsome stranger she would soon meet. Now she wheeled her way amongst the little knots of people, with a plate of food on her lap, chatting here, moving on, chatting there, and moving on again. Eddie guessed she'd been to her share of cocktail parties, not much different from this, and was a little jealous of her aplomb. Eddie began to notice children in the crowd. Apparently the Folkin had decided their visitors weren't going to just haul out their shooting irons and start a massacre. The oldest kids were allowed to wander about on their own. They traveled in the protective packs Eddie recalled from his own childhood, scoring massive amounts of food from the tables, although not even the appetites of voracious teenagers could make much of a dent in that bounty. They watched the outlanders, but none quite dared approach. The youngest children stayed close to their parents. Those of the painful tween age clustered around the slide, swings, and elaborate monkey bar construction at the very far end of the pavilion. A few used the stuff, but most of them only watched the party with the puzzled eyes of those who were somehow caught just wrong ways. Eddie's heart went out to them. He could see how many pairs there were. It was eerie, and guessed that it was these puzzled children, just a little too old to use the playground equipment unselfconsciously, who would give up the greatest number to the wolves. If the wolves were allowed to do their usual thing, that was. He saw none of the runt ones, and guessed they had deliberately been kept apart, lest they cast a pall on the gathering. Eddie could understand that, but hoped they were having a party of their own somewhere. Later he found that this was exactly the case. Cookies and ice cream behind Callahan's church. Jake would have fit perfectly into the middle group of children, had he been of the Kala, but of course he wasn't. And he'd made a friend who suited him perfectly. Older in years, younger in experience. They went about from table to table, grazing at random. Oi trailed at Jake's heels contentedly enough, head always swinging from side to side. Eddie had no doubt whatever that if someone made an aggressive move toward Jake of New York, or his new friend, Benny of the Kala, that fellow would find himself missing a couple of fingers. At one point, Eddie saw the two boys look at each other, and although not a word passed between them, they burst out laughing at exactly the same moment. And Eddie was reminded so forcibly of his own childhood friendships that it hurt. Not that Eddie was allowed much time for introspection. He knew from Roland's stories, and from having seen him in action a couple of times, that the gunslingers of Gilead had been much more than peace officers. They had also been messengers, accountants, sometimes spies, once in a while even executioners. More than anything else, however, they had been diplomats. Eddie, raised by his brother and his friends with such nuggets of wisdom as, "Why can't you eat me like your sister does?" and "I fucked your mother and she sure was fine," not to mention the ever-popular "I don't shut up, I grow up, and when I look at you, I throw up," would never have thought of himself a diplomat, but on the whole, he thought he handled himself pretty well. Only Telford was hard, and the band shut him up, say thank you. God knew it was a case of sink or swim. The Calla folk might be frightened of the wolves, but they weren't shy when it came to asking how Eddie and the others of his tet would handle them. Eddie realized Roland had done him a very big favor, making him speak in front of the entire bunch of them. It had warmed him up a little for this. He told all of them the same things over and over. It would be impossible to talk strategy until they had gotten a good look at the town. Impossible to tell how many men of the Calla would need to join them. Time would show. They'd peak at daylight. There would be water if God willed it. Plus every other cliché he could think of. It even crossed his mind to promise them a chicken in every pot after the wolves were vanquished, but he stayed his tongue before it could wag so far. A smallhold farmer named Borge Estrada wanted to know what they'd do if the wolves decided to light the village on fire. Another, Garrett Strong, wanted Eddie to tell them where the children would be kept safe when the wolves came. "For we can't leave him here, you must ken it very well," he said. Eddie, who realized he kenned very little, sipped at his graph and was noncommittal. A fellow named Neil Faraday, Eddie couldn't tell if he was a smallhold farmer or just a hand, approached and told Eddie this whole thing had gone too far. "They never take all the children, you know," he said. Eddie thought of asking Faraday what he'd make of someone who said, "Well, only two of them raped my wife," and decided to keep the comment to himself. A dark-skinned, mustached fellow named Lewis Haycox introduced himself and told Eddie he had decided T.N. Jaffords was right. He'd spent many sleepless nights since the meeting thinking it over and had finally decided that he would stand and fight. If they wanted him, that was. The combination of sincerity and terror Eddie saw in the man's face touched him deeply. This was no excited kid who didn't know what he was doing, but a full-grown man who probably knew all too well. So here they came with their questions, and there they went with no real answers, but looking more satisfied even so. Eddie talked until his mouth was dry, then exchanged his wooden cup of graff for cold tea, not wanting to get drunk. He didn't want to eat any more either. He was stuffed. But still they came. Cash and Estrada, Strong and Echeverria, Winkler and Spalter, cousins of Overholzer's, they said, Freddy Rosario and Farron Pusella. Or was it Freddy Pusella and Farron Rosario? Every 10 or 15 minutes, the torches would change color again, from red to green, from green to orange, from orange to blue. The jugs of graff circulated, the talk grew louder, so did the laughter. Eddie began to hear more frequent cries of, "You're bugger," and something that sounded like, "Dive down," always followed by laughter. He saw Roland speaking with an old man in a blue cloak. The old fellow had the thickest, longest, whitest beard Eddie had ever seen outside of a TV Bible epic. He spoke earnestly, looking up into Roland's weather-beaten face. Once he touched the gunslinger's arm, pulled it a little, Roland listened, nodded, said nothing, not while Eddie was watching him anyway. "But he's interested," Eddie thought. Oh yeah, old Long, Tall and Ugly is hearing something that interests him a lot. The musicians were trooping back to the bandstand when someone else stepped up to Eddie. It was the fellow who had reminded him of Pa Cartwright. "George Telford," he said. "May you do well, Eddie of New York." He gave his forehead a perfunctory tap with the side of his fist, then opened the hand and held it out. He wore rancher's headgear, a cowboy hat instead of a farmer's sombrero, but his palm felt remarkably soft, except for a line of callus running along the base of his fingers. "That's where he holds the reins," Eddie thought. "And when it comes to work, that's probably it." Eddie gave a little bow. "Long days and pleasant nights, sighed Telford." It crossed his mind to ask if Adam, Hoss, and Little Joe were back at the Ponderosa, but he decided again to keep his wiseacre mouth shut. "May he have twice the number, son, twice the number. He looked at the gun on Eddie's hip, then up at Eddie's face. His eyes were shrewd and not particularly friendly. "Your din wears the mate of that, I can." Eddie smiled, said nothing. "Wayne Overholzer says your cababby put on quite a shooting exhibition with another one. I believe your wife's wearing it tonight?"
"I believe she is,"
Eddie said, not much caring for that cababby thing. He knew very well that Susanna had the Ruger. Roland had decided it would be better if Jake didn't go armed out to Eisenhart's Rocking Bee.
4 against 40 would be quite a pull, wouldn't you say?" Telford asked. "Yar, a hard pull that'd be, or mayhap there might be 60 come in from the east. No one seems to remember for sure, and why would they? 23 years is a long time of peace, tell God I and man Jesus thank you."
Eddie smiled and said a little more nothing, hoping Telford would move along to another subject. Hoping Telford would go away, actually. No such luck. Pissheads always hung around. It was almost a law of nature. Of course, 4 armed against 40 or 60 would be a sight better than 3 armed and 1 standing by to raise a cheer. Especially 4 armed with hard calibers, may you hear me?
"Hear you just fine," Eddie said. Over by the platform where they had been introduced, Zelia Jaffords was telling Susanna something. Eddie thought Suze also looked interested.
"She gets the farmer's wife, Roland gets the Lord of the fucking Rings, Jake gets to make a friend, and what do I get? A guy who looks like Pa Cartwright and cross-examines like Perry Mason."
"Do you have more guns?" Telford asked. "Surely you must have more if you think to make a stand against the wolves."
"Myself, I think the idea's madness. I've made no secret of it. Von Eisenhart feels the same.
Overholzer felt that way and changed his mind," Eddie said, in a just-passing-the-time kind of way. He sipped tea and looked at Telford over the rim of his cup, hoping for a frown, maybe even a brief look of exasperation. He got neither.
"Wayne the weather vane," Telford said, and chuckled. "Yar, yar, swings this way and that. Wouldn't be too sure of him yet, young Si."
Eddie thought of saying, "If you think this is an election, you better think again." And then didn't. Mouth shut, see much, say little.
"Do you have speed shooters, perhaps?" Telford asked. "Or grenados?"
"Oh, well," Eddie said, "that says maybe."
"I never heard of a woman gunslinger."
"No? Or a boy, for that matter, even apprentice.
How are we to know you are who you say you are? Tell me, I beg."
"Well, that's a hard one to answer," Eddie said. He had taken a strong dislike to Telford, who looked too old to have children at risk.
"Yet people will want to know," Telford said.
"Certainly, before they bring the storm."
Eddie remembered Roland's saying, "We may be cast on, but no man may cast us back." It was clear they didn't understand that yet. Certainly Telford didn't. Of course, there were questions that had to be answered, and answered yes. Callahan had mentioned that, and Roland had confirmed it, 3 of them. The first was something about aid and succor. Eddie didn't think those questions had been asked yet, didn't see how they could have been, but he didn't think they would be asked in the gathering hall when the time came. The answers might be given by little people like Pusella and Rosario, who didn't even know what they were saying. People who did have children at risk.
"Who are you, really?" Telford asked. "Tell me, I beg."
"Eddie Dean of New York. I hope you're not questioning my honesty. I hope to Christ you're not doing that."
Telford took a step back, suddenly wary. Eddie was grimly glad to see it. Fear wasn't better than respect, but by God, it was better than nothing.
"Nay, not at all, my friend, please. But tell me this. Have you ever used the gun you carry? Tell me, I beg."
Eddie saw that Telford, although nervous of him, didn't really believe it. Perhaps there was still too much of the old Eddie Dean, the one who really had been of New York, in his face and manner for this rancher Si to believe it, but Eddie didn't think that was it. Not the bottom of it, anyway.
He was a fellow who'd made up his mind to stand by and watch creatures from Thunderclap take the children of his neighbors, and perhaps a man like that simply couldn't believe in the simple, final answers a gun allowed. Eddie had come to know those answers, however, even to love them. He remembered their single, terrible day in Ludd, racing Susanna in her wheelchair under a gray sky while the god drums pounded. He remembered Frank and Luster and Topsy the sailor, thought of a woman named Maud kneeling to kiss one of the lunatics Eddie had shot to death. "What had she said? You shouldn't have shot Winston, for 'twas his birthday," something like that. "I've used this one and the other one and the Ruger as well," he said. "And don't you ever speak to me that way again, my friend, as if the two of us were on the inside of some funny joke. If I offended in any way, Gunslinger, I cry your pardon." Eddie relaxed a little. Gunslinger. At least the silver-haired son of a bitch had the wit to say so, even if he might not believe so. The band produced another flourish. The leader slipped his guitar strap over his head and called, "Come on now, you all, that's enough food. Time to dance it off and sweat it out, so it is." Cheers and yipping cries. There was also a rattle of explosions that caused Eddie to drop his hand, as he had seen Roland drop his on a good many occasions.
"Easy, my friend," Telford said. "Only little bangers. Children setting off reap crackers, you can."
"So it is," Eddie said. "Cry your pardon."
"No need," Telford smiled. It was a handsome Pa Cartwright smile, and in it, Eddie saw one thing clear. This man would never come over to their side. Not, that was, until and unless every wolf out of Thunderclap lay dead for the town's inspection in this very pavilion. And if that happened, he would claim to have been with them from the very first.
8. The dancing went on until moonrise, and that night the moon showed clear. Eddie took his turn with several ladies of the town. Twice he waltzed with Susanna in his arms, and when they danced the squares, she turned and crossed, Allemand left, Allemand right, in her wheelchair with pretty precision. By the ever-changing light of the torches, her face was damp and delighted. Roland also danced, gracefully, but, Eddie thought, with no real enjoyment or flair for it. Certainly, there was nothing in it to prepare them for what ended the evening. Jake and Benny Slightman had wandered off on their own, but once Eddie saw them kneeling beneath a tree and playing a game that looked suspiciously like Mumbletypeg. When the dancing was done, there was singing. This began with the band itself, a mournful love ballad, and then an up-tempo number so deep in the Kalos patois that Eddie couldn't follow the lyric. He didn't have to in order to know it was at least mildly ribald. There were shouts and laughter from the men and screams of glee from the ladies. Some of the older ones covered their ears. After these first two tunes, several people from the Kala mounted the bandstand to sing. Eddie didn't think any of them would have gotten very far in Star Search, but each was greeted warmly as they stepped to the front of the band and were cheered lustily, and in the case of one pretty young matron, lustfully, as they stepped down. Two girls of about 9, obviously identical twins, sang a ballad called Streets of Campara in perfect, aching harmony, accompanied by just a single guitar which one of them played. Eddie was struck by the rapt silence in which the falcon listened. Although most of the men were now deep in drink, not a single one of these broke the attentive quiet. No baby bangers went off. A good many, the one named Haycox among them, listened with tears streaming down their faces. If asked earlier, Eddie would have said of course he understood the emotional weight beneath which this town was laboring. He hadn't. He knew that now. When the song about the kidnapped woman and the dying cowboy ended, there was a moment of utter silence. Not even the nightbirds cried. It was followed by wild applause. Eddie thought, if they showed hands on what to do about the wolves right now,
Not even Pa Cartwright would dare vote to stand aside. The girls curtsied and leaped nimbly down to the grass. Eddie thought that would be it for the night. But then, to his surprise, Callahan climbed on stage. He said, "Here's an even sadder song my mother taught me," and then launched into a cheerful Irish ditty called "Buy Me Another Round, You Booger You." It was at least as dirty as the one the band had played earlier, but this time Eddie could understand most of the words. He and the rest of the town gleefully joined in on the last line of every verse. "Before you's put me in the ground, buy me another round, you booger you." Susanna rolled her wheelchair over to the gazebo and was helped up during the round of applause that followed the old fellow's song. She spoke briefly to the three guitarists and showed them something on the neck of one of the instruments. They all nodded. Eddie guessed they either knew the song or a version of it. The crowd waited expectantly, none more so than the lady's husband. He was delighted, but not entirely surprised, when she voyaged upon "Maid of Constant Sorrow," which she had sometimes sung on the trail. Susanna was no Joan Baez, but her voice was true, full of emotion. And why not? It was the song of a woman who has left her home for a strange place. When she finished, there was no silence, as after the little girl's duet, but a round of honest, enthusiastic applause. There were cries of "Yah!" and "Again!" and "More staves!" Susanna offered no more staves, for she'd sung all the ones she knew, but gave them a deep curtsy instead. Eddie clapped until his hands hurt, then stuck his fingers in the corners of his mouth and whistled. And then, the wonders of this evening would never end, it seemed, Roland himself was climbing up as Susanna was handed carefully down. Jake and his new pal were at Eddie's side. Benny Sleitman was carrying Oi. Until tonight, Eddie would have said the bumbler would have bitten anyone not of Jake's quartet who tried that.
"Can he sing?" Jake asked.
"News to me if he can, kiddo," Eddie said. "Let's see." He had no idea what to expect, and was a little amused at how hard his heart was thumping.
9. Roland removed his holstered gun and cartridge belt. He handed them down to Susanna, who took them and strapped on the belt high at the waist. The cloth of her shirt pulled tight when she did it, and for a moment, Eddie thought her breasts looked bigger. Then he dismissed it as a trick of the light. The torches were orange. Roland stood in their light, gunless and as slim-hipped as a boy. For a moment he only looked out over the silent, watching faces, and Eddie felt Jake's hand, cold and small, creep into his own. There was no need for the boy to say what he was thinking, because Eddie was thinking it himself. Never had he seen a man who looked so lonely, so far from the run of human life with its fellowship and warmth. To see him here, in this place of fiesta, for it was a fiesta, no matter how desperate the business that lay behind it might be, only underlined the truth of him. He was the last. There was no other. If Eddie, Susanna, Jake, and Oi were of his line, they were only a distant shoot, far from the trunk. Afterthoughts, almost. Roland, however. Roland. Hush. Eddie thought, you don't want to think about such things, not tonight. Slowly, Roland crossed his arms over his chest, narrow and tight, so he could lay the palm of his right hand on his left cheek and the palm of his left hand on his right cheek. This meant zilch to Eddie, but the reaction from the 700 or so Kala folk was immediate, a jubilant, approving roar that went far beyond mere applause. Eddie remembered a Rolling Stones concert he'd been to. The crowd had made that same sound when the Stones' drummer, Charlie Watts, began to tap his cowbell in a syncopated rhythm that could only mean honky-tonk woman. Roland stood as he was, arms crossed, palms on cheeks, until they quieted.
"We are well met in the Kala," he said. "Hear me, I beg."
"We say thank ye," they roared, "and hear you very well."
Roland nodded and smiled,
but I and my friends have been far, and we have much yet to do and see. Now, while we bide, will you open to us, if we open to you?"
Eddie felt a chill. He felt Jake's hand tighten on his own. "It's the first of the questions," he thought. Before the thought was completed, they had roared their answer, "Aye, and thank ye."
"Do you see us for what we are, and accept what we do?"
There goes the second one, Eddie thought. And now, it was him squeezing Jake's hand. He saw Telford and the one named Diego Adams exchange a dismayed, knowing look. The look of men suddenly realizing that the deal is going down right in front of them and they are helpless to do anything about it. "Too late, boys," Eddie thought.
"Gunslingers," someone shouted. "Gunslingers, fair and true, say thanky in God's name."
Roars of approval. A thunder of shouts and applause, cries of thanky and aye, and even your bugger. As they quieted, Eddie waited for him to ask the last question, the most important one, "Do you seek aid and succor?" Roland didn't ask it. He said merely, "We'd go our way for tonight and put down our heads, for we're tired. But I'd give you one final song and a little steptoe before we leave, so I would, for I believe you know both." A jubilant roar of agreement met this. They knew it all right.
"I know it myself, and love it," said Roland of Gilead. "I know it of old, and never expected to hear the rice song again from any lips, least of all from my own. I am older now, so I am, and not so limber as I once was. Cry your pardon for the steps I get wrong."
"Gunslinger, we say thanky," a woman called. "Such joy we feel, aye."
"And do I not feel the same?" the gunslinger asked gently. "Do I not give you joy from my joy, and water I carried with the strength of my arm and my heart?
Give you to eat of the green crop,"
they chanted as one, and Eddie felt his back prickle and his eyes tear up.
"Oh, my God," Jake sighed. "He knows so much."
"Give you joy of the rice," Roland said.
He stood for a moment longer in the orange glow, as if gathering his strength, and then he began to dance, something that was caught between a jig and a tap routine. It was slow at first, very slow, heel and toe, again and again his boot heels made that fist-on-coffin-top sound, but now it had rhythm. Just rhythm at first, and then, as the gunslinger's feet began to pick up speed, it was more than rhythm. It became a kind of jive. That was the only word Eddie could think of, the only one that seemed to fit. Susanna rolled up to them. Her eyes were huge, her smile amazed. She clasped her hands tightly between her breasts.
"Oh, Eddie," she breathed, "did you know he could do this? Did you have any slightest idea?"
"No," Eddie said. "No idea." Ten. Faster moved the gunslinger's feet in their battered and broken old boots, then faster still. The rhythm becoming clearer and clearer, and Jake suddenly realized he knew that beat. Knew it from the first time he'd gone toe dash in New York. Before meeting Eddie, a young black man with Walkman earphones on his head had strolled past him, bopping his sandaled feet and going, "Cha-da-ba, cha-da-bow," under his breath. And that was the rhythm Roland was beating out on the bandstand, each bow accomplished by a forward kick of the leg and a hard skip of the heel on wood. Around them, people began to clap, not on the beat, but on the offbeat. They were starting to sway. Those women wearing skirts held them out and swirled them. The expression Jake saw on all the faces, oldest to youngest, was the same, pure joy. Not just that, he thought, and remembered a phrase his English teacher had used about how some books make us feel, the ecstasy of perfect recognition. Sweat began to gleam on Roland's face. He lowered his crossed arms and started clapping. When he did, the Kalafokan began to chant one word over and over on the beat, "Come, come, come,
Come! It occurred to Jake that this was the word some kids used for jizz, and he suddenly doubted if that was mere coincidence. Of course it's not, like the black guy bopping to that same beat. It's all the beam. And it's all 19. Come, come, come. Eddie and Susanna had joined in. Benny had joined in. Jake abandoned thought and did the same. 11. In the end, Eddie had no real idea what the words to the Rice song might have been. Not because of the dialect, not in Roland's case, but because they spilled out too fast to follow. Once, on TV, he'd heard a tobacco auctioneer in South Carolina. This was like that. There were hard rhymes, soft rhymes, off rhymes, even rape rhymes, words that didn't rhyme at all but were forced to for a moment within the borders of the song. It wasn't a song, not really. It was like a chant, or some delirious street corner hip-hop. That was the closest Eddie could come. And all the while, Roland's feet pounded out their entrancing rhythm on the boards. All the while, the crowd clapped and chanted, "Come, come, come, come." What Eddie could pick out went like this.
Come, come, Kamala, rice come a falla, hississa ea brala, de come a falla. Down come a river, arise we kiver, rice be a greeno, see all we see no the greeno, come, come, Kamala. Come, Kamala, rice come a falla, deep in a walla, grass come, Kamala, under the sky, oh, grass green and high, oh, girl and her fella, lie down together, they slippy a slide, oh, under a sky, oh, come, Kamala, rice come a falla.
At least three more verses followed these two. By then, Eddie had lost track of the words, but he was pretty sure he got the idea. A young man and woman planting both rice and children in the spring of the year. The song's tempo, suicidally speedy to begin with, sped up and up until the words were nothing but a jargon spew and the crowd was clapping so rapidly their hands were a blur. And the heels of Roland's boots had disappeared entirely. Eddie would have said it was impossible for anyone to dance at that speed, especially after having consumed a heavy meal. Slow down, Roland, he thought. It's not like we can call 911 if you vapor lock. Then, on some signal neither Eddie, Susanna, nor Jake understood, Roland and the Kalafokan stopped in mid-career, threw their hands to the sky, and thrust their hips forward as if in coitus. Kamala, they shouted, and that was the end. Roland swayed, sweat pouring down his cheeks and brow, and tumbled off the stage into the crowd. Eddie's heart took a sharp upward lurch in his chest. Susanna cried out and began to roll her wheelchair forward. Jake stopped her before she could get far, grabbing one of the push handles.
I think it's part of the show, he said. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is too, Benny Sleitman said.
The crowd cheered and applauded. Roland was conveyed through them and above them by willing, upraised arms. His own arms were raised to the stars. His chest heaved like a bellows. Eddie watched in a kind of hilarious disbelief as the gunslinger rolled toward them as if on the crest of a wave.
"Roland sings, Roland dances, and to top it all off," he said, "Roland stage dives like Joey Ramone."
"What are you talking about, sugar?" Susanna asked.
Eddie shook his head.
"Doesn't matter. But nothing can top that. It's got to be the end of the party."
It was. 12. Half an hour later, four riders moved slowly down the high street of Calabrin Sturgis. One was wrapped in a heavy salide. Frosty plumes came from their mouths and those of their mounts on each exhale. The sky was filled with a cold strew of diamond chips, Old Star and Old Mother brightest among them. Jake had already gone his way with the Sleitmans to Eisenhart's Rocking Bee. Callahan led the other three travelers, riding a bit ahead of them, but before leading them anywhere, he insisted on wrapping Roland in the heavy blanket.
"You say it's not even a mile to your place?"
Roland began.
"Never mind your blather," Callahan said.
The clouds have rolled away, the nights turned nigh on cold enough to snow, and you danced a Kamala such as I've never seen in my years here.
How many years would that be? Roland asked. Callahan shook his head.
I don't know. Truly, gunslinger, I don't. I know well enough when I came here that was the winter of 1983, 9 years after I left the town of Jerusalem's lot. 9 years after I got this.
He raised his scarred hand briefly.
Looks like a burn, Eddie remarked.
Callahan nodded, but said no more on the subject.
In any case, time over here is different, as you all must very well know.
It's in drift, Susanna said, like the point of the compass.
Roland, already wrapped in the blanket, had seen Jake off with a word and with something else as well. Eddie heard the clink of metal as something passed from the hand of the gunslinger to that of the prentice. A bit of money, perhaps? Jake and Benny Sleitman rode off into the dark side by side. When Jake turned and offered a final wave, Eddie had returned it with a surprising pang.
Christ, you're not his father, he thought.
That was true, but it didn't make the pang go away.
Will he be all right, Roland?
Eddie had expected no other answer but yes, had wanted nothing more than a bit of balm for that pang. So the gunslinger's long silence alarmed him. At long last, Roland replied, "We'll hope so." And on the subject of Jake Chambers, he would say no more. 13. Now here was Callahan's church, a low and simple log building with a cross mounted over the door.
"What name do you call it, Pear?"
Roland asked.
"Our Lady of Serenity."
Roland nodded. "Good enough."
"Do you feel it?" Callahan asked. "Do any of you feel it?"
He didn't have to say what he was talking about. Roland, Eddie, and Susanna sat quietly for perhaps an entire minute. At last, Roland shook his head. Callahan nodded, satisfied.
"It sleeps."
He paused, then added,
"Tell God thank you." "Something's there, though," Eddie said. He nodded toward the church. "It's like a, I don't know, a weight almost."
"Yes," Callahan said, "like a weight. It's awful. But tonight it sleeps, God be thanked." He sketched a cross in the frosty air. Down a plain dirt track, but smooth and bordered with carefully tended hedges, was another log building. Callahan's house, what he called the rectory.
"Will you tell us your story tonight?" Roland said.
Callahan glanced at the gunslinger's thin, exhausted face and shook his head.
"Not a word of it, Si. Not even if you were fresh. Mine is no story for starlight. Tomorrow at breakfast, before you and your friends are off on your errands, would that suit?"
"Aye," Roland said. "What if it wakes up in the night?" Susanna asked and cocked her head toward the church. "Wakes up and sends us Todash."
"Then we'll go," Roland said.
"You've got an idea what to do with it, don't you?" Eddie asked.
"Perhaps," Roland said.
They started down the path to the house, including Callahan among them as naturally as breathing.
"Anything to do with that old Manny guy you were talking to?"
Eddie asked.
"Perhaps,"
Roland repeated. He looked at Callahan.
"Tell me, Pear, has it ever sent you Todash?
You know the word, don't you?"
"I know it," Callahan said. "Twice. Once to Mexico, a little town called Los Zapatos, and once, I think, to the castle of the king. I believe that I was very lucky to get back that second time."
"What king are you talking about?" Susanna asked. "Arthur Eld?"
Callahan shook his head. The scar on his forehead glared in the starlight.
"Best not to talk about it now," he said. "Not at night."
He looked at Eddie sadly.
"The wolves are coming. Bad enough. Now comes a young man who tells me the Red Sox lost the World Series again. To the Mets?"
"Afraid so," Eddie said. And his description of the final game, a game that made little sense to Roland, although it sounded a bit like points, called wickets by some, carried them up to the house. Callahan had a housekeeper. She was not in evidence, but had left a pot of hot chocolate on the hob. While they drank it, Susanna said, "Zelia Jaffords told me something that might interest you, Roland." The gunslinger raised his eyebrows.
Her husband's grandfather lives with them. He's reputed to be the oldest man in Colibrin Sturgis. Tian and the old man haven't been on good terms in years. Zelia isn't even sure what they're pissed off about. It's that old. But Zelia gets on with him very well. She says he's gotten quite senile over the last couple of years, but he still has his bright days. And he claims to have seen one of these wolves. Dead. She paused. He claims to have killed it himself.
My soul, Callahan exclaimed. You don't say so.
I do. Or rather, Zelia did.
That, Roland said, would be a tale worth hearing. Was it the last time the wolves came?
No, Susanna said, and not the time before, when even Overholzer would have been not long out of his clouts, the time before that.
If they come every 23 years, Eddie said, that's almost 70 years ago.
Susanna nodded, but he was a man grown even then. He told Zelia that a moit of them stood out on the west road and waited for the wolves to come. I don't know how many a moit might be.
5 or 6,
Roland said. He was nodding over his chocolate. Anyway, Tian's grandpère was among them, and they killed one of the wolves.
What was it? Eddie asked. What did it look like with its mask off?
She didn't say, Susanna replied. I don't think he told her. But we ought to...
A snore arose, long and deep. Eddie and Susanna turned, startled. The gunslinger had fallen asleep. His chin was on his breastbone. His arms were crossed, as if he'd drifted off to sleep, still thinking of the dance and the rice. 14. There was only one extra bedroom, so Roland bunked in with Callahan. Eddie and Susanna were thus afforded a sort of rough honeymoon. Their first night together by themselves, in a bed and under a roof. They were not too tired to take advantage of it. Afterward, Susanna passed immediately into sleep. Eddie lay awake a little while. Hesitantly, he sent his mind out in the direction of Callahan's tidy little church, trying to touch the thing that lay within. Probably a bad idea, but he couldn't resist at least trying. There was nothing. Or rather, a nothing in front of a something.
I could wake it up, Eddie thought. I really think I could.
Yes, and someone with an infected tooth could rap it with a hammer, but why would you?
We'll have to wake it up eventually. I think we're going to need it.
Perhaps, but that was for another day. It was time to let this one go. Yet for a while, Eddie was incapable of doing that. Images flashed in his mind like bits of broken mirror in bright sunlight. The Kala lying spread out below them beneath the cloudy sky. The Divartiti Hwai, a gray ribbon. The green beds at its edge, rice kamafala. Jake and Benny Slightman looking at each other and laughing without a word passed between them to account for it. The aisle of green grass between the high street and the pavilion. The torches changing color. Oi, bowing and speaking,
Eld, thank ye,
with perfect clarity. Susanna singing, I've known sorrow all my days. Yet what he remembered most clearly was Roland standing slim and gunless on the boards, with his arms crossed at the chest and his hands pressed against his cheeks. Those faded blue eyes looking out of the falcon. Roland asking questions, 2 of 3, and then the sound of his boots on the boards, slow at first, then speeding up faster and faster until they were a blur in the torchlight, clapping, sweating, smiling, yet his eyes didn't smile. Not those blue bombardier's eyes, they were as cold as ever. Yet how he had danced! Great God, how he had danced in the light of the torches! Come, come, Kamala, rice, come, Afala, Eddie thought. Beside him, Susanna moaned in some dream. Eddie turned to her, slipped his hand beneath her arm so he could cup her breast. His last thought was for Jake. They had better take care of him out at that ranch. If they didn't, they were going to be one sorry-ass bunch of cowpunchers. Eddie slept. There were no dreams. And beneath them, as the night lengthened and the moon set, this borderland world turned like a dying clock.
Chapter 2 Dry Twist 1 Roland awoke from another vile dream of Jericho Hill in the hour before dawn. The horn. Something about Arthur Eld's horn. Beside him in the big bed, the old fellow slept with a frown on his face, as if caught in his own bad dream. It creased his broad brow zigzag, breaking the arms of the cross scarred into the skin there. It was pain that had wakened Roland, not his dream of the horn spilling from Cuthbert's hand as his old friend fell. The gunslinger was caught in a vice of it from the hips all the way down to his ankles. He could visualize the pain as a series of bright and burning rings. This was how he paid for his outrageous exertions of the night before. If that was all would have been well. But he knew there was more to this than just having danced the Kamala a little too enthusiastically. Nor was it the rheumatiz, as he had been telling himself these last few weeks, his body's necessary period of adjustment to the damp weather of this fall season. He was not blind to the way his ankles, especially the right one, had begun to thicken. He had observed a similar thickening of his knees, and although his hips still looked fine, when he placed his hands on them, he could feel the way the right one was changing under the skin. No, not the rheumatiz that had afflicted Court so miserably in his last year or so, keeping him inside by his fire on rainy days. This was something worse. It was arthritis. The bad kind, the dry kind. It wouldn't be long before it reached his hands. Roland would gladly have fed his right one to the disease if that would have satisfied it. He had taught it to do a good many things since the lobstrosities had taken the first two fingers, but it was never going to be what it was. Only ailments didn't work that way, did they? You couldn't placate them with sacrifices. The arthritis would come when it came and go where it wanted to go. I might have a year, he thought. Lying in bed beside the sleeping religious from Eddie and Susanna and Jake's world. I might even have two. No, not two. Probably not even one. What was it Eddie sometimes said? Quit kidding yourself. Eddie had a lot of sayings from his world, but that was a particularly good one, a particularly apt one. Not that he would cry off the tower if old Bone-Twist Man took his ability to shoot, saddle a horse, cut a strip of rawhide, even to chop wood for a campfire, so simple a thing as that. No, he was in it until the end. But he didn't relish the picture of riding along behind the others, dependent upon them, perhaps tied to his saddle with the reins because he could no longer hold the pommel. Nothing but a drag anchor, one they wouldn't be able to pull up, if and when fast sailing was required. If it gets to that, I'll kill myself. But he wouldn't. That was the truth. Quit kidding yourself. Which brought Eddie to mind again. He needed to talk to Eddie about Susanna, and right away. This was the knowledge with which he had awakened, and perhaps worth the pain. It wouldn't be a pleasant talk, but it had to be done. It was time Eddie knew about Mia. She would find it more difficult to slip away now that they were in a town, in a house, but she would have to, just the same. She could argue with her baby's needs and her own cravings no more than Roland could argue with the bright rings of pain which circled his right hip and knee and both ankles, but had so far spared his talented hands. If Eddie wasn't warned, there might be terrible trouble. More trouble was something they didn't need now. It might sink them. Roland lay in the bed. And throbbed, and watched the sky lighten. He was dismayed to see that brightness no longer bloomed dead east. It was a little off to the south now. Sunrise was also in drift. 2. The housekeeper was good-looking, about 40. Her name was Rosalita Munoz, and when she saw the way Roland walked to the table, she said, "One cup coffee, then you come with me." Callahan cocked his head at Roland when she went to the stove to get the pot. Eddie and Susanna weren't up yet. The two of them had the kitchen to themselves. "How bad is it with you, sir?" "It's only the rheumatiz," Roland said. "Goes through all my family on my father's side.
It'll work out by noon, given bright sunshine and dry air.
I know about the rheumatiz, Callahan said. Tell God thank you it's no worse.
I do. And to Rosalita, who brought heavy mugs of steaming coffee, I tell you thank you as well.
She put down the cups, curtsied, and then regarded him shyly and gravely.
I never saw the rice dance kicked better, sigh.
Roland smiled crookedly. I'm paying for it this morning.
I'll fix you, she said. I've a cat oil, special to me. It'll first take the pain and then the limp. Ask Per.
Roland looked at Callahan, who nodded. Then I'll take you up on it. Thank you, Si.
She curtsied again and left them.
I need a map of the Kala, Roland said when she was gone. It doesn't have to be great art, but it has to be accurate. And true as to distance. Can you draw one for me?
Not at all, Callahan said composedly. I cartoon a little, but I couldn't draw you a map that would take you as far as the river, not even if you put a gun to my head. It's just not a talent I have. But I know two that could help you there, he raised his voice. Rosalita, Rosie, come to me a minute, do you?
3. 20 minutes later, Rosalita took Roland by the hand, her grip firm and dry. She led him into the pantry and closed the door.
Drop your breeches, I beg, she said. Be not shy, for I doubt you've anything I haven't seen before. Unless men are built somewhat different in Gilead than the Inners.
I don't believe they are, Roland said, and let his pants fall. The sun was now up, but Eddie and Susanna were still down. Roland was in no hurry to wake them. There would be plenty of early days ahead, and late evenings, too, likely, but this morning let them enjoy the peace of a roof over their heads, the comfort of a feather mattress beneath their bodies, and the exquisite privacy afforded by a door between their secret selves and the rest of the world. Rosalita, a bottle of pale, oily liquid in one hand, drew in a hiss over her full lower lip. She looked at Roland's right knee, then touched his right hip with her left hand. He flinched away a bit from the touch, although it was gentleness itself. She raised her eyes to him. They were so dark a brown they were almost black.
This isn't rheumatiz. It's arthritis, the kind that spreads fast.
Aye, where I come from, some call it dry twist, he said. Not a word of it to the pair, or to my friends.
Those dark eyes regarded him steadily.
You won't be able to keep this a secret for long.
I hear you very well, yet while I can keep the secret, I will keep the secret. And you'll help me.
Aye, she said, no fear. I'll bide ye.
Say thank you. Now, will that help me?
She looked at the bottle and smiled.
Aye, it's mint and sprigum from the swamp. But the secret's the cat's bile that's in it, not but 3 drops in each bottle you can. They're the rock cats that come in out of the desert from the direction of the great darkness.
She tipped up the bottle and poured a little of the oily stuff into her palm. The smell of the mint struck Roland's nose at once, followed by some other smell, a lower smell, which was far less pleasant.
Yes, he reckoned, that could be the bile of a puma or a cougar or whatever they meant by a rock cat in these parts. When she bent and rubbed it into his kneecaps, the heat was immediate and intense, almost too strong to bear. But when it moderated a bit, there was more relief than he would have dared hope for.
When she had finished anointing him, she said,
"How be your body now, gunslinger, Si?"
Instead of answering with his mouth, he crushed her against his lean, undressed body and hugged her tightly. She hugged him back, with an artless lack of shame, and whispered in his ear,
"If he are who he say he are, he mustn't let un take the babbies, no, not a single one. Never mind what the big bugs like Eisenhart and Telford might say."
"We'll do the best we can," he said.
"Good. Thank you."
She stepped back, looked down.
"One part of he has no arthritis. No rheumatiz either. Looks quite lively. Perhaps a lady might look at the moon tonight, gunslinger, and pine for company."
"Perhaps she'll find it," Roland said. "Will you give me a bottle of that stuff to take on my travels around the Kala? Or is it too dear?"
"Nay, not too dear," she said.
In her flirting,
She had smiled. Now she looked grave again. But we'll only help you a little while, I think.
I know, Roland said, and no matter, we spread the time as we can, but in the end, the world takes it all back.
Aye, she said. So it does.
4. When he came out of the pantry, buckling his belt, he finally heard stirring in the other room. The murmur of Eddie's voice followed by a sleepy peal of female laughter. Callahan was at the stove, pouring himself fresh coffee. Roland went to him and spoke rapidly.
I saw pokeberries on the left of your drive between here and your church.
Yes, and they're ripe. Your eyes are sharp.
Never mind my eyes, do you? I would go out to pick my hatful. I'd have Eddie join me while his wife perhaps cracks an egg or three. Can you manage that?
I believe so, but...
Good, Roland said, and went out.
5. By the time Eddie came, Roland had already half-filled his hat with the orange berries and also eaten several good handfuls. The pain in his legs and hips had faded with amazing rapidity. As he picked, he wondered how much Court would have paid for a single bottle of Rosalita Munoz's cat oil.
Man, those look like the wax fruit our mother used to put out on a doily every Thanksgiving, Eddie said. Can you really eat them?
Roland picked a pokeberry almost as big as the tip of his own finger and popped it into Eddie's mouth.
Does that taste like wax, Eddie?
Eddie's eyes, cautious to begin with, suddenly widened. He swallowed, grinned, and reached for more.
Like cranberries, only sweeter. I wonder if Suze knows how to make muffins. Even if she doesn't, I bet Callahan's housekeeper...
Listen to me, Eddie. Listen closely and keep a rein on your emotions, for your father's sake.
Eddie had been reaching for a bush that was particularly heavy with pokeberries. Now he stopped and simply looked at Roland, his face expressionless. In this early light, Roland could see how much older Eddie looked. How much he had grown up was really extraordinary.
What is it?
Roland, who had held this secret in his own counsel until it seemed more complex than it really was surprised at how quickly and simply it was told. And Eddie, he saw, wasn't completely surprised.
How long have you known?
Roland listened for accusation in this question and heard none.
For certain?
Since I first saw her slip into the woods. Saw her eating.
Roland paused.
What she was eating. Heard her speaking with people who weren't there. I've suspected much longer, since Lud.
And didn't tell me?
No. Neither recriminations would come, and a generous helping of Eddie's sarcasm. Except, they didn't.
You want to know if I'm pissed, don't you? If I'm going to make this a problem.
Are you?
No, I'm not angry, Roland.
Exasperated, maybe.
And I'm scared to fucking death for Suze, but why would I be angry with you? Aren't you the Din?
It was Eddie's turn to pause. When he spoke again, he was more specific. It wasn't easy for him, but he got it out.
Aren't you my Din?
Yes, Roland said. He reached out and touched Eddie's arm. He was astounded by his desire, almost his need, to explain. He resisted it. If Eddie could call him not just Din, but his Din, he ought to behave as Din. What he said was, "You don't seem exactly stunned by my news."
"Oh, I'm surprised," Eddie said. "Maybe not stunned, but, well..."
He picked berries and dropped them into Roland's hat.
"I saw some things, okay? Sometimes she's too pale. Sometimes she winces and grabs at herself, but if you ask her, she says it's just gas. And her boobs are bigger, I'm sure of it. But Roland, she's still having her period. A month or so ago, I saw her burying the rags, and they were bloody, soaked. How can that be? If she caught pregnant when we pulled Jake through, while she was keeping the demon of the circle occupied, that's got to be 4 months at least, and probably 5. Even allowing for the way time slips around now, it's got to be.
Roland nodded. "I know she's been having her monthlies, and that's proof conclusive it isn't your baby. The thing she's carrying scorns her woman's blood." Roland thought of her squeezing the frog in her fist, popping it, drinking its black bile, licking it from her fingers like syrup.
"Would it?"
Eddie made as if to eat one of the pokeberries, decided against it, and tossed it into Roland's hat instead. Roland thought it would be a while before Eddie felt the stirrings of true appetite again.
Roland, would it even look like a human baby?
Almost surely not.
What then? And before he could